One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Welcome to Queer Storytime, the podcast. This is a brave space for sharing queer and trans stories of radical affirmation, acceptance, empowerment, and healing. I'm your host, Stevie Ingram. I so look forward to you joining us. If you haven't done so already, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast. Alrighty, y'all, queer in 3, 2, 1. Let's go. Hey, y'all. Today, we've got QST's first queer couple joining together for episode 14. This episode features Robin and Chris, an American lesbian couple who are also fellow podcasters and host the Coming Out Late podcast, of which I was recently invited onto myself. If you'd like to hear my interview with Robin and Chris, please check out my two-part episode on the Coming Out Late podcast by listening to episodes 130 and 131. In both of these episodes, I discuss a bit about my own journey in addition to the cultural conditionings surrounding the gender binary and how it has shaped our lives as queer and trans people. Without further ado, I invite you to join me for a brief moment of centering and ease. As always, I invite you into a comfortable seated position, with the eyes gently closed or having a downward cast gaze. And as we enter this brief moment of awareness, simply tuning into the body, specifically noting where in the body you feel places of tension or restriction, it might be in the neck, the shoulders, the abdomen, or elsewhere. Just simply acknowledge these places in your inner awareness. And now contrasting this with acknowledging spaces in the body where you have feelings of openness or spaciousness. Stay tuned in to that felt sense of spaciousness and openness in the body. You may feel this in the heart center or elsewhere. Seeing how long you can maintain awareness on this feeling of openness and spaciousness. If you're not feeling this sense of spaciousness, I encourage you to look for a place in the body that simply feels neutral. There's no negative sensations, no positive sensations. Just simply observing neutrality in the body. And as you move your awareness throughout the body, always continuing to be aware of the breath. Allowing awareness of breath to gently guide you to various places in your own body. Just a few more moments here. Feelings of breath, feelings of spaciousness, feelings of neutrality. Take one more deep breath in and a big sigh out through the mouth. Then as you're ready, opening the eyes and reintegrating your awareness into the room that surrounds you. Now that we're feeling all centered and at ease, I'll introduce today's guests, Robin and Chris. Since coming out late at the age of 54, Robin has since dedicated the past 3 years of her life to creating resources and safe spaces for other queer folks coming out late in life. Robin's podcast, Coming Out Late, ranks in the top 1.5% globally. Her private Facebook, also under the Coming Out Late moniker, is growing at a rate of 50 to 100 requests to join per week and is currently at over 5,300 lesbian, bi, non-binary, and transgender women who have all come out late in life. Robin also facilitates 3 weekly support groups for any late bloomer from her Facebook group who wishes to find their people and receive support in a safe environment. To round out her offerings to this special and rapidly growing subset of the LGBTQIA+ community, Robin also offers one-on-one private coaching to late bloomers and facilitates 3 in-person coming out late retreats across the United States. And most recently, Robin has been asked to submit a proposal to a publishing house to write a guidebook about coming out late for lesbians. And last but not least, today's second guest is Chris, who is a 500-hour certified yoga teacher, and this year will soon become a certified yoga therapist. With a strong devotion to the practice, study, and teachings of yoga and recovery, Chris shares these valuable teachings to help others with their journey in recovery from addiction. Chris approaches healing, discovery, and recovery beyond just the physical benefits of Hatha yoga, otherwise in the West known as Hatha yoga, by infusing the teachings with her passion to share all of the mind, body, spirit tools that she discovered and acquired through yoga, Ayurveda, and recovery. Welcome both Robin and Chris to Queer Storytime. I'm so excited to have you here and join me on my side of the queer podcasting world. Why don't you start out telling us about yourselves and your coming out late journey?
Thanks, Stevie. It's great to be here and to see you again. My coming out late process started about 4 years ago. Actually, 4 years ago, exactly. It was right at the beginning of COVID. And I'm going to use a term that Robin always uses, is there were many breadcrumbs before that. And it seems that the longer I'm out, the longer I'm out, meaning the longer I'm out, the longer I realize I knew. So for me, what seemed like this just moment of like, oh my God, I'm gay. And it happened on my front porch, and a friend came up the porch, and I just had this moment of like, I just saw this friend in a different way that I'd never seen her before. And that was when I'd said to myself, oh my God, I'm gay. So I had this kind of interesting like process of coming out to myself and then going back in and coming out and going back in. And how that happened was I had a shaman I was working with. And I actually think that he had released some energy for me or some blockage that actually allowed myself to see this, that moment that I saw, heard myself say, I'm gay. Prior to that, I think I'd had these moments, but I was so blocked and still in denial. And, you know, I kept kind of tucking these things away. I'd been getting more of like, oh, what was that? But then I'd be like, oh no. And I would sort of tuck it away. So that was 4 years ago. And I don't know how much you want me to get into that, but I will just say it was, to kind of keep it a little brief, it was 2 years of sharing it with a very small community. I had these two women that I had been doing sort of like a covenant group from this church we belong to. And then I have a really good friend who's in recovery with me. I actually met her the first day that I entered a recovery room, recovery from addiction. And that was about 10 years ago. And so she was the first person I told, then the shaman, and then these two other women and a therapist. I think so I'd had this therapist that I'd been seeing a few years back and I hadn't seen her in a while and called her and said, I think I have some things I need to work through. And so, yeah, with that small group of people, just would share and I would read things. I read Billie Jean King's story. I read Glennon Doyle, started watching The L Word just to like identify with people. And important to note that at that point, I have two kids and I'm separated, was married with two kids. And I wanted to go through this process with as much integrity and care for the other people in my life, because I knew that there was going to be a pretty big ripple effect. I have two girls who are now 12 and 14. And the younger one was 8, I guess, when I had the discovery, and the older one was 10. It was really important to me to move through this with as much integrity as possible. And also just to take my time to really give myself time to learn about who I am and what did this mean for me. And as you know, Stevie, we've talked about the previous podcast. I'm a yogi and a yoga therapist, or soon to be. I used a lot of the practices of yoga, and also a lot of 12-step work helped uncover things. But the yoga practices really held me, allowed me to be quiet and just be with all the things that came up during that time. Yeah, so that was the beginning. I think it's probably a good place to pause and let Robin come in, or let you ask questions if you have any.
Yeah, I have so many things that just resonated with me with what you said, but I want to allow Robin to talk about her coming out late journey.
Sure. Thank you, Stevie. Thanks for having us on today. What a crazy journey it has been. I would say I had my aha moment. Mine was, holy shit, I'm gay. And that was in 2015, May of 2015. So I've been out about 9 years. And I, at the time, was married to a man and had also two daughters who were, one was about to go off to college in August and the other was in college. After I said, holy shit, I'm gay, I gasped, you know, and said that. And then I just laughed. I mean, it's just so comical in a way. I just couldn't even believe it. And I didn't know, you know, it wasn't like I had been it's not that I had been consciously stuffing it down my whole life. What I've learned in looking back, because hindsight is 2020, that there were a lot of breadcrumbs. My coming out process probably started when I was 45 or 44. And it was a 10-year process of the universe just dropping hints. And in the beginning, there were very few and far between. So I just didn't get it. And finally, towards the end, you know, I believe that the universe, my higher power, just picked up a 2x4 and whopped me upside the head and said, you're gay, you're gay. And because I needed that kind of wake up call. And looking back, the only sign that I knew definitively was when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I had a crush on my tennis teacher. My mom had put me in tennis lessons. And I didn't know it was a crush. I just knew that I wanted to be around her all the time and, you know, wanted to be the teachers. I mean, I was 8, you know, and they were probably freshmen in college or something. And I just really looked up to her and I wanted to be in her energy all the time. And I look back and I'm thinking, oh, that's what that was. I often wonder what the trajectory of that path would have been. But about 15 months later, my mother died when I was 10. So that just put me in a whole different, you know, I was kind of sleepwalking through life at that point, you know, dealing with that trauma, which took me probably decades to deal with, you know, in all honesty, I'm probably still dealing with that. It was so easy as being someone who was dealing with trauma to just follow what was around. I didn't know there was not a lot of representation of gay people. And if there was, it was something to be shunned. And, you know, you don't want to be that. And I can't point to any one particular person or people who made me feel that way. It was just some kind of something in the air in our social norms that I just knew and didn't really know too many gay people. And although I did play a lot of sports in high school, and really wanted to play sports in college. And somebody, I don't remember who it was, kind of whispered in my ear and said, well, you know, there are a lot of lesbians who play sports in college. And I was like, oh shit, I don't want to catch that. You know, like whatever that is, I didn't want to. And I actually denied myself the opportunity to play sports in high school because I was afraid. And I now know later that I think my fear was, you know, that it was something that I did want to become or wanted to be, or maybe knew I was, but feared it. So yeah, finally in 2015, after doing some serious research, which was crazy, you know, I had met 8 or 9 women online that said that they were formerly married to men and had come out late in life. And I was like, oh my God, this is a thing. And then I found out about a couple of books, read a couple of books, and coincidentally, well, not so coincidentally, and coincidentally, at the same time, my marriage was going downhill. We were barely speaking to each other, not very friendly or kind to one another. I didn't know how I was going to get out of that marriage. And I do believe today, with all my heart, that acknowledging my sexuality, that I am a lesbian and I am gay, that gave me the strength to file for divorce and move forward. And it was not a good divorce at all. I didn't come out to him. I didn't tell him why I was filing for divorce. Unfortunately, he had stolen my laptop and found out that I had been questioning and immediately, unbeknownst to me, outed me to my 2 daughters and to pretty much everybody we knew, I think, at that point. I didn't know. I went on for another 5 years thinking I was still in the closet to my kids. We don't live in the same state, so they're not around. You know, it's been tumultuous. And even though it's been tumultuous and painful, it's the best thing I could have done for myself. I think it was just this morning, Chris and I were saying, like, we're so happy to be gay. You know, like, it's just the best. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me, besides meeting Chris.
I feel the love. That's beautiful. Yeah, I think both of you point to what we're talking about when I was on your podcast about the conditionings that all of us have to work through. Like you said, Robin, I like that phrase that you said, like there's something in the air. And I think that what's in the air is the expectation that everyone is heterosexual or cisgender. So if either of you have any thoughts on like when you recognize that and how you parsed the world of heteronormativity, would love to hear your thoughts. Okay. And like how you navigated that.
How I navigated it was I avoided anything that was remotely gay. I avoided it like the plague because I certainly didn't want to be that. And like I said, I had a pretty mellow upbringing with regard to homosexuality. Honestly, it's like it was the vapors in the air. I do not know where, well, maybe media. I mean, maybe it was through media, comments here and there. I can remember 1 or 2 guys in high school that I thought were maybe gay, but gay wasn't even a word in my brain much, you know, it was weird. And somehow, I wish I could point to something in particular. I think Chris has better examples than I do. I can't point to any example other than like people use the word faggot. And I didn't even know what that was at first, but it was clearly derogatory. And it was almost always aimed at a cisgendered man who made or boy. It was always aimed at a boy. So that I knew was bad. That just popped into my head. For me, I think they were more subtle things. Chris, do you have examples?
I do. I just looked up when the AIDS epidemic started. And it started in 1981. Yes. And it actually makes me want to cry because I realized like I was 9. And I always say before I was 10, I knew that I wanted to be a boy. I wanted to play professional baseball or professional football. And I tried to try out for the Little League team. My dad wouldn't let me play. few years before my brother was playing. There was a girl on the team and everybody called her a lesbian and he didn't want his daughter to be a lesbian. So there was that. And I did have some other examples. Like we had a gay couple that lived down the street and they were always harassed. And there was always like spray paint on the road outside of their house with like arrows saying faggots live here. And their house was always getting toilet paper and such. So it wasn't friendly. Then the AIDS epidemic started. And I remember what I heard around all of that. It was not supportive and compassionate of the people who were going through. They were bad and something about them was wrong. And that's what I heard. That was the message I received as a 9-year-old during that time. So that might have been a little bit of what was in the air where I grew up. And then I was also an athlete. I just clearly remember my coaches in middle school and high school. I had several who were gay and were not openly, were not out. I mean, people knew, and it just didn't seem like a life I wanted to live. I remember seeing them and how they hid and the shame that they had. And I don't think I consciously said, well, I don't want to live that kind of life. But somewhere underneath, there was definitely a choice to not go that way. And I also had an internal homophobia and I moved with that for a long time, probably until my coming out, which I was 46, 47, coming out to myself. I think for me, that was enough. And boy, do I wish that I could have seen it another way and could have been braver and been one of the people who was able to say, well, I don't care. This is who I am. But for some reason, I didn't know. I tucked it away and this is my path. I'd love to have a different past and I don't want to. I said to Robin yesterday, there's a reason. Like she could not have started a podcast and a support group of over 5,000 people. She would not be supporting this group if she didn't have the experience that she had. And now I'm a part of the group and I'm able to support the group. I've been able to lead support groups and started Tuesday night support group, which is more gender expansive, which thank you. We got that term from you, Stevie. Thank you so much. We thought non-binary at first, but then I was like, oh, but I just want it to be like really expansive. And I was like, oh, Stevie used the term gender expansive. And so it's all inclusive. I wouldn't be able to be supporting these other people in their journeys if I didn't have the journey that I have. So thank you for asking that question. I hadn't thought about that part about the AIDS epidemic.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Absolutely. And it was a topic that we discussed on the previous episode. But what you were saying, Chris, reminds me of like, how can we use our suffering for good in the world? And all three of us here are doing that with our podcast and with your support groups and everything else we're doing, all of our activism. I think that's one amazing thing about the resilience of our community is that we really do transform our suffering into a hell of a lot of good in the world so that we can be the representation that we never had growing up. So that is just sitting on my heart right now and it's really beautiful. So thank you too for that.
Oh, thank you. We call that the wounded healer.
Absolutely. Robin, I don't know if you had anything to say. I want to allow you to speak.
I'm so glad that Chris brought up the AIDS epidemic and I'm a little older than Chris and I was probably sophomore year in college. But there had to have been things that led up to that. It was a scary time. There were so many voices in the air at that time, voicing their opinions about what was going on. It was very confusing. I would like to speak to what Chris brought up about, you know, the past. I don't have any regret about my past. Every now and then, I think, oh, it would have been fun to maybe have had experiences in college or explored my sexuality. At the same time, I realized this is my path. Like, I feel so lucky that I figured it out at 54 years old and that I'm able to live the last 9 years completely different. I also walk around and think, well, what else don't I know about myself if I didn't know that for 54 years? I also help to coach and counsel people who really can't get past their grief about coming out so late. I try to help them with that in terms of let's not look in our rearview mirror. Let's look ahead what we can do today, how we can enjoy life today. There's nothing we can do about the past. Absolutely nothing.
Right. Well, that's a good conversation. We haven't had much conversation here on Queer Storytime in regards to grief and healing grief. Why don't we talk a little bit more about that?
OK, Can I just say something before we go into that? Because I don't like something that I said. I talked about the coaches and the examples that I had in my growing up. I'd said that they lived in shame. I don't know that they lived with shame. They probably lived with fear. And I think it was my shame that I was feeling. And so I'm projecting shame onto them. And I don't want to do that. I don't know what their experience was like. I think it probably was incredibly difficult and scary, and they were courageous. I just want to honor those people who were brave enough to come out when they came out. And, you know, I never was connected to those coaches. I actually really gave one a hard time. I really was not nice. I was just difficult. I'm sort of connected with her on Facebook through other people. So another person who taught with her. And I actually reached out to her and I apologized and I thanked her for everything that she did for us. It was a sweet little amends that I was able to make, and she received it really nicely. I was really grateful that she was so gracious and was able to receive that, because not everybody can, and she did, and it was really nice. And that may be the only contact I have with her going forward. I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that I'm grateful for those people who were able to do that when they did.
Absolutely. Especially at such a scary time for our community, especially for the lesbian community that we're taking care of.
People were hiding. They were going to underground bars, right? A lot of people moved out to Provincetown and places like that to be safe. So it was not easy.
Right. Getting back to the grief points, I think all of us have to work through this mourning, MOURN, not daylight mourning. We all have to go through this mourning process. I spoke of my experience growing up in the Christian church and having to deal with all the rhetoric that I experienced in church. But then I think both of you have pointed to that there were these cultural issues going on, whether it's people, you know, saying the F word, the three-lettered F word, or the AIDS epidemic. There's been a tremendous amount of mourning and grief that our community has had to processed through, and even still now today with all of these laws that are being created against our community and just all of the advocacy that we have to do for ourselves to simply be able to exist in this world. So I'm curious how both of you have approached that mourning and grief process throughout your journey, which I know to anyone listening, this is a difficult topic to talk about. It's not the most pleasant topic, but I think it's just a reality of life. And so I think, you know, the more tools that we can have to work through our own grief and hearing the stories and struggles of those that have come before us, those that are in the older generation, especially for youth, to be able to provide them with some tools and working through all of this is super beneficial. So what are both of your thoughts on this?
There's a lot of mourning going on in the coming out late community. So we've been hammered all our lives that you grow up, you be a good girl, you get good grades, maybe you go to college, you meet a man, you get married, you have children, you get a house. This was the path. I went through life with blinders on, like, okay, that's my path. And then I did all of that and I had all of that and I still wasn't happy. And it was painful to recognize that, my God, what's wrong with me that I can't be happy with all of this? And with this person, you know, that I'm living with and married to, it carries such weight to it. And when I'm not out talking to people about it, it's a weight that I'm carrying by myself. And then, you know, I go through the divorce process and come out as a gay person, gay woman. I now have to mourn and grieve that which was hammered into me my whole life, that that's what I was supposed to have. So now what? That fairy tale story didn't come true, the one that I was, you know, working so hard all my life to achieve. And that's quite a shock. It's like, wow, this is not how the fairy tale was supposed to end. And I actually think I'm way better off. I've never been happier. I've never felt more myself. I've never felt more free. I'm learning so much just by being in the gay community. My mind and my heart have opened up so much more than I was when I was living as a heterosexual woman. But yeah, there was a lot of grieving. You know, as much as I did not like my ex-husband and it was a contentious divorce, there was a grieving. I share that with the community that I work with, and they can't wait to get divorced, so many of these women. And I say, just be prepared that you may also feel sadness, you know, when that happens, because you're losing a part of yourself that you thought you were supposed to have. So yeah, it's fascinating. There was one time, might have been the weekend I came out to myself, I sat down by the water where my lake house was, and just these sounds came out of me that sounded like mating whales. Like, I've never cried like that in my life. And it was deep and visceral. And I know it was this coming out of the mourning and the grief, you know, and just thinking like, what is to be? And the fear behind not knowing what my future looked like. That moment really stands out to me, that I was almost regurgitating or just vomiting out this old life and not knowing what the new life was going to look like. And it was frightening.
Absolutely.
I relate to that, Robin, that noise. Oh my gosh. I never thought of it as mating whales, but I can imagine that's what it sounds like. You know, mine came, it's funny, in this church community. I don't know why I feel like I want to qualify this, but I'm not religious. But I had been going to this non-denominational church where I met these two amazing healers. And one was the minister and the other was his wife. The minister was also a therapist that I saw for a while when I was in a really low point in my life. And he had passed, and then I was doing this work with his wife. She was in my little covenant group. This was again during COVID. So I guess this must have been after I had my aha moment. I didn't even realize like how it comes together. The sermon was on being the beloved. I'd always believed in God or some higher spirit, universe, whatever we want to call it. I think of it as more like energy. I always believed there was something great, you know, even as a child, I would lay in the woods. I grew up in New Hampshire, and I would lay in the woods under these pine trees, and I would look up at the sky and just be like, oh, if God made us, like who made God? And I would just ask these really big questions. And with all of that said, there was a point in my life where I think I was born beloved. I'm just going to use that word. And at some point in my life, it had slipped away. I would imagine it was around 10 or 12, like right around there. So here I was in my late 40s in this sermon. And well, I always kind of would see other people and think like, yeah, they are, but I'm not really. I believe there's something greater, but I'm not really worthy of that. Something's wrong with me. I'm not worthy of this belovedness. And so anyway, the sermon happened and I just had this moment of like, oh my God, me too. I realized that I am beloved. And then I did the wailing, like the sound came out of me that I had never heard before. I think that I had this aha moment of, oh my gosh, this is who I am, meaning that my authentic self is I'm gay. And having that realization at some point, it sort of came together with this sermon of like, oh, now there isn't something wrong with me. It was almost like pieces fit together. It was like, oh, that's why. And I realized that at that moment, it just sort of all fit together and that I felt a lot of grief in that moment. It was almost like I lived all of these years not knowing this. And I actually asked the group, I asked them, why didn't anybody tell me? You know, I've heard Robin say this, and it sort of fits with this as well, with coming out. And I will say, why didn't anyone tell me? And people told me. I had people say to me, I can't wait until you figure out you're gay. And I had such denial that I was like, no way. So that's just what came up from what I heard Robin share. I know there's more grief and healing that I've had, but I'm going to send it back to you two first.
Yeah, the other grief that I was reminded of is the grief of losing people as a result of coming out late. You know, we might lose siblings, we might lose our parents, we might lose our church. You know, there are a lot of things that are on the line.
Our children.
Our children, exactly. Our jobs, you know, our lives. I mean, I have to move through the world a little differently now that I'm Chris and I need to be a little careful where and how we show affection, live in the South. So there's a grief around that. You know, even just knowing that I have to sometimes look over my shoulder or be careful, which it's infuriating too.
Yeah.
I also have a grief around the judgment, all of the judgment that I had. And I think that's why I wanted to revisit what I said about my coaches. I definitely had judgment and had these beliefs that weren't kind. And, you know, it blocked relationships. And I certainly wasn't lifting other people up because of it. I was trying to push them down, make them somehow less than I was.
It's amazing what we do out of fear. When the fear of something that's different from us that we're not used to, and we just fear it, so we push it away or we try to overcome it, overtake it. I mean, I'm not proud of that either.
I think I have a lot of grief around being one of them.
Absolutely. This is all pointing to themes that have come up on Queer Storytime, and I'm sure continually on your podcast as well, about this like holding on that we have to do to these false narratives just to navigate the world safely in a world that doesn't make space for queerness or gender expansiveness or whatever. And, you know, taking into account too the burden, the absolute burden that is on all of us for years on years on years on years to hold on to that. I'm not diagnosing anybody with a psychological condition here, but I do want to point to that there is a diagnosis that's accepted in more so in Europe, not so much in the US, but it's called complex post-traumatic stress. And I think that diagnosis is giving voice to what we're talking about, that so many in our community, because of the grief and the mourning and the intense feelings and the burden that we're holding on to and the hatred and discrimination, that's giving a name to our experiences, and that these things are repeated throughout our lifetimes. That becomes traumatic. It does become post-traumatic stress because it's not just one event that we've experienced in our lives. It's a multitude of repeated events, not only due to the narratives that we have in our own head, due to the narratives in churches, in society, and it's really, really difficult for us to navigate our lives when everything feels like it's a threat. And to heal our nervous systems, as Chris, I know you'll resonate with this, but this is one major reason why yoga is so important, is because it provides us with actual tools to begin healing our nervous system from times when we've constantly felt like we can't be ourselves and constantly moving through life with that burden of not showing up as our authentic self. So that's just something that's continually on my mind in having these conversations that we do on Queer Storytime and on your podcast as well. So I'm curious how you all have been able to move through this. And I know we're talking, this conversation might feel a little bit heavy to people listening, and it feels a little heavy to me right now. I think it's important that we talk about this, but I'm also curious to how you both have overcome this burden and this complex stress and trauma that you've had to navigate throughout your lives. Like, what are practical tools moving from like this darkness into experiencing the joy of your identity and the lightness and the expansiveness of your identity?
Thank you, Stevie. I would first say, for me, absolutely, yoga has been such a wonderful healing modality, not only the practice of the asana, the movement, but also the inquiry, the kindness, like ahimsa, doing no harm to myself and to others, like positive self-talk, meditation, just noticing, right? Especially when the negative thoughts do come in, because of my meditation practice, I can notice them and then shift the thinking, and breath work. And that's just been really important part of my healing, especially with my energies, because I have mainly been a pretty anxious person, short and impulsive most of my life. I think breath work really has helped me so much with balancing. But back to just a few things I wanted to touch on. The movement practice for me, it started out, my entry into yoga was power vinyasa yoga. What I learned is slowing down, slowing down, slowing down. Even the asana, the yoga movement practice, in so many different ways to help allow myself not only to listen to myself, but also to listen to my intuition and be in touch with my intuition, but also to rest. We have a lot of people who are coming into the community who talk about their pain. They have a lot of physical pain. And so I think that is a result of so many things, but I think in particular stress. And the more for me that I could relax and even just let go of the holding in the body and allow myself to process, that has been really big. And then the last thing is just community. Finding community has been vital. So I was really fortunate to find Robin's community actually through a wild little, like, I think, divine process. Just briefly, I had a friend in Provincetown who went to a book reading, and she said, "Oh, had you read this book? Because I guess I must have said some things that connected," that she was like, "Oh, this person says the same thing." So I read the book. It was Late Bloomer. Funny. And she, Melissa Guyverson, had been a part of a coming out later group in Connecticut, where I live. And so I was like, I want to know this group. And I was looking for the group and I couldn't find it. And I looked at the book. And so finally I was like, just reach out to her. So I found her contact and asked her. The group was no more. And so she said, why don't you look online for some groups on Facebook? I think she said specifically coming out late. And so that's how I found Robin's group. Oh, and I just have to say, because of my yoga community and because of recovery communities, I knew that community was vital, because, you know, we say together we can, and things like you're not alone.
Oh, wow. That was great. I do want to say that one of the cool things that Chris has been bringing to our community, particularly in the support groups, is because we talk about difficult things in there, and two of the three support groups take place in the evening. And one of our attendees said, is there any way we could do meditation or something before we end the meeting? Because it would help settle us down, you know, and just kind of ground us. And so we've been doing that. Chris has been gracious enough to be taking us out in meditation in those meetings. And it's been making a big difference. And people stay for it, which is great. So it's really neat that Chris is now bringing in, and we hope to bring more and more of that in. And people are asking for it, both indirectly and directly, asking for ways that they can adjust to what they're going through and adapt to what they're going through, accept what they're going through, and move through it with compassion for their partners. It's just been beautiful to watch. So for me, I don't have a yoga background until I've met Chris. And it's really funny to hear the yin and yang of this, because the way I've navigated it all is to find community. And I had a little bit of it when I was still living in New Jersey, but not a lot. And then some circumstances happened in my life. And I don't know what made me think of a podcast, but I said, I need to start a support group. I'm also in 12-step recovery. And in there, we meet in Zoom as a result of the pandemic. So I went full force ahead and really wanted to create community. And I didn't know what I was doing, who was going to show up. I started with really no people in the Facebook group. And as Chris said, we're 5,300 strong. Every week, I get between 40 and 100 people who want to join our Facebook group saying that I'm coming out late and I'd like support. It's incredible. The podcast, you know, has been around for almost 3 years. Coming Out Late is the name of the podcast. And that is now has been in the top 1.5% globally, is ranked. So there's a need out there for people, for community. There's such a need for community. And then a year ago, I added retreats, in-person retreats, and people fill up very quickly. People can't get enough of them. They actually want Chris and I to do pop-up events in all these additional cities. They don't know where to find their people. They want a tribe, you know, and it really helps. It's said week after week in some of these support groups that they're so grateful that they have a place to go. Many of these people, they don't know any other gay people. Some of them, they've even called in when it was their first night in their very own apartment for the first time in their life, because they went from their parents' homes to their husband's homes. And it's so touching. So I would say building this community has helped me feel a part of and proud of and heal and really heal and know that there's nothing wrong with me and there's nothing wrong with any of us. We just gather together. I mean, if I had a dollar for every time someone said I thought I was alone, and we're not. And I thought that when I came out, I thought I was going crazy, you know, and I did think I was all alone. Other women couldn't possibly be feeling what I'm feeling and going through. Turns out there's thousands of us.
And I have to say, Robin said she didn't know what she was doing, but she does it really well. And there is healing in the telling of our stories. And by Robin, what she does is gives this platform for people to come and tell their stories. And it often is the first place they've told their stories. And for a long time, the only place that they're talking about this. And then for that like little expansive community we have, it's the first place that people are exploring this other side.
It's the same thing. Support group, that's a little community that, my God, the things that people have shared in that group, in the gender expansive group, is just incredible. Just incredible.
Yeah, we're learning about binding.
I love that.
Although a lot of us had already been binding with like sports bras and such, but we're learning about different ways to bind and
I'm so thrilled for both of you that you have this amazing community that you've built up.
yeah.
It's awesome. And I'm grateful to have been a part of your podcast. I just wanted to come back to this topic of addiction, which I know is another heavy topic. So we're just breaching all the heavy topics today, but it's important to talk about because, again, it's not a topic that has really been present on this podcast yet. And one of my goals for Queer Storytime is to have as diverse experiences as possible on all ends of the planet. I personally never struggled with addiction. I can't speak to that experience at all. So I would love for you both to share on your experiences with addiction for those in our community that are listening that may also be suffering from addiction, either actively or, on the journey of sobriety.
Yeah, for me, I would say I started around sometime around 8th grade. I said already that I was an athlete. I actually also had an uncle who was in recovery who would spend the weekends at our house, and he would be like, "If I ever catch you drinking or smoking or doing drugs, I'll kill you before your mother." So we were almost afraid, my brother and I, to do those things. But I remember in 8th grade, I had gained a lot of weight. It was that kind of that time as a young person where body was changing, and I started dieting and exercising, and I started going to the gym. I was the only girl in the gym. So for me, it started with exercise and food. And eventually to other substances. The eating disorder sort of went away when the alcohol came in. For me, it was more alcohol than anything. I never really experiment with a lot of drugs or many at all. And if you've heard of, Steve, you've probably heard of Gabor Mate.
Yes, I love him.
Yes, he calls it the one addiction process, which I think is fabulous. I can identify with that because, to be honest with you, I could be addicted to anything. I can't eat an M&M, I'll eat the whole bag. So it was just sort of flip-flopping one for the other was my point. And I don't know a lot about this, but I've heard, and I think it's Gabor Mate talks about how addiction can start with a trauma. And I believe that it was this trauma of not being able to be who I was or I am. Really dissociating. And, I remember sitting in a classroom in 10th grade, feeling my body. I said to myself, I think God gave me a body that was too small. Almost felt like my skin was too tight on me. And that's gone with me through my whole life, that I just didn't feel right in my skin. And I think I tried to numb that out for a lot of my 20s, my 30s. And whether it was with food, or exercise or alcohol. I will say that I do think that my coming out process has something to do with my getting sober, like giving myself the space, time, the inquiry of who am I, those questions that we ask in recovery. Yeah, it's been the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Wonderful.
I would say for me as well that recovery has been the best thing that's ever happened to me. Coming out late and recovery, it's given me life. It's given me my life back. It's helping me to discover life. It's interesting because I had the trauma young when I was 10, my mother died. I didn't start drinking until high school, early high school. I was kind of afraid to start because I didn't really have a safety net of parents. That could catch me if I screwed up. So I didn't experiment much beyond pot and alcohol. For me, and we say this in recovery, that addiction and alcoholism is but a symptom of something deeper and bigger. And it's not easy to stop drinking when you're drinking alcoholically. And I can say I'll be 4 years sober in August. Opposite of Chris, I came out first and then I got sober. I came out in 2015 and I got sober in 2020. For today, I'm sober and I'm working on my emotional sobriety now. And that's what I love about the recovery program that I'm in. It dives really deep. Once you've gotten somewhat of a handle on your drinking or a handle on your drinking and you stop drinking for a period of time, and for me, it's forever, I now am working on my emotional sobriety, you know, which is being of acceptance. I don't point fingers and blame things. I look at myself and say, what was my part in it? It's having me turn over my will and my life over to a power greater than myself. So it does require me to think about something bigger than me. It takes a lot of the focus off of self and off of ego. It's just a really beautiful program that requires me to be of service to others and to move through life with loving kindness. You know, you can't beat that. You really can't beat that. And it's been a really cool journey. It was tough in the beginning, really hard. It was hard to even acknowledge or admit for me that I had a drinking problem. Coincidentally or not so coincidentally, my mother died of alcoholism at the age of 41 when I was 10. So I didn't want to become her. I didn't want to be that. And just like I didn't want to be gay, I don't want to be an alcoholic. There are a lot of things I didn't want to be. And I've often said that I am really grateful that I am an alcoholic because it brought me to this program. It's a spiritual program. It's not religious. And I'm spiritual, not religious. It's all the things that I've wanted in my life. You know, I've got the best of both worlds. I can be out and gay, and I've got this wonderful spiritual life. You know, and now I'm going to be, through Chris, learning more about yoga and that kind of healing. And I want to bring that, we want to bring that to the community that's coming out late, you know, because they are in dire need of wanting to heal. So for me, my recovery program also helps me heal as well.
That's wonderful.
Go ahead. The word, Stevie, was incongruent. You also had introduced us to that word, incongruent. I believe that's part of why I drank, was there was this incongruency.
Yeah.
With who I was and how I was presenting. Mm. Certainly a part of it.
I drank because I was angry. I was pissed off that my mom died. And then my father got remarried. And that was a horrendous experience. I was angry. So I just drank out of anger. You know, I drank at the world. And that's the other beautiful thing about the recovery program that I'm in, is that there's no room for anger. That's just not who I want to be, you know, in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's good to be having this conversation because so much of the queer community, especially now on my end when I was hanging around the gay male community, how heavily focused it is on drinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't speak being amongst the lesbian community too much. I certainly have gone to lesbian bars. It's a struggle. I remember having this inner conflict when I was younger, going into gay male communities and just questioning, like, what is the obsession with all the drinking? At that point in my life, I didn't have all of the education that I do now. It's bringing forth the question of, like, how can young queer and trans people navigate dealing with their suffering without substance use?
I love that question. I'm a part of this community called the Triangle Community, and I've just really only done a little bit with them, so I shouldn't say I'm a part yet, but I feel a part. They were so welcoming, but they do a lot with the young people. And I just think I'm going to go back to community is the answer, because I think we look for the community in the bars, and a lot of us, and healthy community is really the answer. There's so many people who are exploring. And I see it, and for us with the coming out later in Robin's group, like I say this to Robin all the time, like I'm amazed at how many people come to our group and they share it. They're like, we don't want to be going to the bars. We don't want to be meeting people like that. And that's not everyone. There are people who are looking to do it differently. And I guess my thinking on that is really finding a healthy community to do that in, safe place to explore this, all of this.
Absolutely. I love that that's being created now. Even we're seeing the typical bar spaces, but without the alcohol.
Mm.
You can go dance to techno music, which I love to do occasionally, not so much as I get older, but you know, every once in a while. But the pressure is there. It's just there to get drunk off your ass. And that has defined fun, quote unquote, in the queer and trans community. But my point is that it's nice to see that there are other options for our community. And I've just been thinking throughout this whole conversation that we, you know, being podcast host advocates, we are creating that community where more toxicity and trauma does not have to manifest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty open. A lot of people in recovery are not open about being in recovery. And I am. And part of the reason I am is that I remember being in a meeting, one of our support groups, there must have been 6 or 8 of us, because we came out as being in recovery. A few other hands went up. People were talking in the chat in Zoom, you know, like, I'm in recovery too, and or I'm sober. You know, I want to be visible as somebody who's also in recovery so that it can possibly encourage someone else. And yeah, I just wanted to also echo what Chris said, that there's somebody who's not even 30 years old yet, and they don't want to be a part of the drinking scene. You know, they're like, I'm tired at night. I want to be home by 9:30 and not drunk, you know? And I just think it's great. I do believe there is a moving away from that, you know, of the younger people as well, I hope. So we'll see.
Absolutely. This is kind of moving in a slightly different direction than the sobriety conversation and addiction conversation, but, and maybe this is the direction things are moving in, but I know there's a lot of conversation about lesbian spaces specifically going, no longer existing, essentially.
Evaporating.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, for sure. I actually became friendly with the producers of the Lesbian Bar Project, who has been, you know, promoting for the last several years how they're becoming extinct, you know, lesbian bar places. And I know COVID had a huge impact on that as well. You know, I think part of the problem is that women don't have the same kind of disposable income, lesbians, as possibly males do. And I do find that women, once they couple up, they tend to then gravitate towards house parties. So they keep to themselves, they don't go out, they want to be in bed early, and or they socialize with very small circles of friends that they've made. And at the same time, I am actually seeing new lesbian bars opening up as well, or queer bars. You know, they may not be completely lesbian, but there are new queer bars opening up as well. There's one in Philly, who I kind of followed their story about them getting their permits and raising money to open. There's one out in Portland, Oregon that we're going to go to, because that's where my retreat is going to take place, called the Sports Bra. Uh-huh. I don't know anything about it, but yeah, they are. And there's a young lesbian couple. They actually took my idea. I really wanted to do this. They hopped in a van and they've been traveling to all the, I'm going to say 13, but I don't even know if that's an accurate number. There are 13 original lesbian bars remaining, but they were podcasting and visiting all of the remaining lesbian bars that were around. They're there, but I think part of it is because maybe people don't want to go out and drink. For some of the reasons that I just outlined too, people are socializing through house parties and other ways.
I mean, that's certainly not a bad thing.
No.
And I do think you're right. Just the standards and expectations placed on women or those assigned female at birth have led to this decline, whereas it's easier, especially for gay men or bisexual men, to have the monetary capacity to hold up these businesses, essentially. Yep.
Absolutely. I mean, the women in my coming out late group, they can't even afford to get divorced. With the housing market the way it is today, many of them were stay-at-home moms or worked part-time. They're sure as heck not going to spend the $10 that they have and go drink it away. You know, a lot of them are responsible for childcare if they have children. So how do you go out to a lesbian bar when you have kids? Having a house party is easier if you host something. So yeah, it's too bad.
Can I ask a question? I don't really know much about this, especially being, you know, in sobriety. So I don't know much about what's going on in the bars. As I'm hearing you both talk, I'm wondering, does it have something to do with the gender expansiveness? Because I feel like lesbian and gay is almost like keeps us in the binary. And I don't know, does it have something to do with people are more fluid? And so wanting it to be a more expansive experience, or is it something else?
I think that's possible. The few newer bars that I've seen open are really tout themselves more as queer spaces.
Yeah.
Not so much lesbian bars.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal conversation to have. There's the whole conversation about TERFs, T-E-R-F-S, trans exclusionary radical feminists, which are essentially lesbians that don't want to hang around trans women. And I would say to a degree that also might be on the gay male side, that they don't want trans men in gay male spaces, which interestingly enough, you only hear about TERFs. You don't hear about it on the opposite end of the spectrum, which that's a curious thing to discuss.
Something that we've experienced in our coming out late community is that what I would call lifelong lesbians have a real bias towards women coming out late in life. You know, you're not really gay. You had sex with a man. How do you call yourself lesbian? Like, we have this older lesbian community telling us what we can and can't call ourselves. I have not experienced it firsthand. However, there are a lot of people in my group and in my larger community who said, yeah, like, we're not met. Or they try to go to local meetups and they feel really out of place because everyone's questioning, well, what do you mean you're still married? There are many people in my group that have opened their marriages. They're a lesbian, their husband's straight, and lifelong lesbians look at that and say, I'm not going to date you. You're still married. You know, you still have a husband. They haven't caught up with the changes. And there are beautiful changes happening, like what I think Chris alluded to, that maybe we won't be having lesbian bars and gay bars, but just queer spaces, which would be wonderful. But there is a lot of prejudice from the older gay community. And I try to let those people know that I'm really grateful for the path that they walked, you know, for me, because it's not that my journey's easier per se, it's different from their journey. I would not have had to go through what they went through. And, you know, try telling somebody who you've been married to since high school or college, you know, after 30 years that, you know what, oops, I'm gay, you know, like, oops, guess what? I mean, there's a lot of challenge and a lot of heartache and a lot of pain going through that process too. So I just wish everybody would agree that, like, this shit's hard and we all get along. And if I say I'm a lesbian, then I'm a lesbian. You know, don't question that because I was married.
Right. Yeah. It's almost as if we have, like, these policing politics for a community that is against policing. Mm-hmm. We sure police ourselves.
Yes. It doesn't make any sense to me. I come out and I want to just love and welcome everyone. And, you know, I get it, man. I know about Stonewall. I can imagine what it was like to have to stay in the closet, you know?
Yeah, it's not easy.
No, it's not easy. Well, these conversations are to be continued. So many great conversations. You know, these are always ongoing conversations. I don't think there's any one right answer to solving the disconnect within our own community. And like you said, Robin, the prejudice that our own community projects onto one another, I believe for their own lack of healing. You know, we have this whole organization called quote unquote Gays Against Groomers. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're very popular on TikTok, but it's literally a group of gays and lesbians that are calling transgender people groomers. And this is the last thing I'll say on this topic. But the thing of it all to me is, like, the rhetoric that they're now using against trans and non-binary people is the same exact rhetoric, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that was used against gay and bisexual people.
Wow.
So we're just perpetuating that harm, which, you know, Chris, when you mentioned the idea of ahimsa, which is non-harm, that's not only a practice of, like, reflecting on how am I harming other people, but it's an active disruption of harm. Like, how can we within ourselves and, like, externally out in the world and in community disrupt this harm that is being perpetuated? So
I was not aware of that group.
Yeah, yes. It's so sad that that even exists.
You know, there's a ripple effect of everything we do. I talk about it a lot. It's things we do might not affect the next person directly, but it'll affect people indirectly. And that energy expands out. And then the next person behaves that way, and then the next. And so it's really important to pay attention.
I think of the phrase, like, we have to clean up our own house, not only individually, but as a community. And again, coming back to yoga, I think this is why these Eastern practices can be so beneficial, because it almost forces us to deal with our shit in a healthy way. and to kind of call ourselves out when we are perpetuating things that are harming others.
And you just summed up recovery. We have an expression in recovery about keeping my side of the street clean. I can't worry about the Joneses and whether they clean up, and I ought not to criticize them. I haven't walked a mile in their shoes. I don't know what's going on in their life. You know, just keep my side of the street clean and my house clean.
Absolutely. Well, nearing the end of Queer Story Time, I have these super soul questions. So there's a couple of questions that I like to ask all of my guests at the end. The first one of which, and of course, I want both of you to answer all of these questions, is given all of your life experiences, what do you feel your life purpose is?
To heal and help others to heal.
How about you, Chris?
I would say it's very similar. I think about how I can empower people toward their own healing.
Absolutely. God knows we need it, or whatever divine entity there is in the universe.
And you know, Stevie, in particular, I do think it's probably with people in recovery and people coming out late. And I often say that we're all in recovery. But in particular, those two groups, I go back to the wounded healer. You know, we've been given this gift for a reason. And so we have the opportunity to help other people walk this path.
I'm healing from compulsory heterosexuality. And I'm healing from the patriarchy. I really do believe we are all healing from this stuff.
Yeah, I love that idea that you just put forth, Chris, is regardless of whether we struggle personally with substance use, there absolutely is recovery involved in that. But we are, Robin, as you just said, we are all healing and recovering from compulsory heterosexuality and compulsory cisgender identity.
Patriarchy.
Patriarchy, white supremacy, all of it.
It's a lot.
Well, it's a lot.
I really do believe that we are all healing from multiple things.
Absolutely. Second question is, given what you know now, what would you tell your younger self about your identity?
I think I would tell myself to just be exactly who you are, and that you are loved, and that you are good. There's an inherent goodness in all of us, and to just have fun with it all and speak your truth, as I choked it down for so long.
I would say be yourself and you are enough and have fun. I think that's the other thing that our culture, our society does not do enough, play and have fun. I think we take life far too seriously.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so if anyone's listening that is wanting to come to one of Robin's retreats.
Yeah.
And genuine fun, like belly laughs. Robin and I have a lot of belly laughs.
We do.
Healthy belly laughs.
Mm-hmm. That's great. One way in which we can experience queer and trans joy, belly laughing.
Mm-hmm. Euphoria.
Euphoria. Instead of dysphoria.
Exactly.
This is a bit of a load. Well, actually, these next two questions are a bit of loaded questions, but what's one thing that you wish others, especially those in the cisgender heterosexual community, understood about the gender and sexually expansive community?
I got my answer already. We are people too.
I love that. And I like what I heard in one of your podcasts was walk in our shoes.
Absolutely.
And I might also add, don't be afraid. You know, don't live in fear.
Yeah, and I said this already, like me too, I get it. I've been there too. And I think what's really important, how I want to move forward in my life is with compassion and kindness, even toward the people who are doing me harm.
That's a difficult one.
Yes, it is.
But we can talk about this more on the flip side of this next question, because it's talk about having compassion for people that are doing us harm. My question is, what do you say to all of these lawmakers globally that are creating laws against us? And then I think the follow-up to that, given our conversation a moment ago, is how do you navigate holding compassion and loving kindness towards those that are inflicting suffering because of their own suffering?
I don't know how to be succinct with my response to the first part of that question. It would be something along the lines of their ancestors, well, and the children that are coming after them. Can you visualize the face of your grandchild on those who you want to vindicate and create these laws against? Somehow I would want to reach a nerve in them that they can really relate to and say, oh my God, what am I doing?
I'm not sure. I'm really like kind of blank on the answer because it's almost too big for me. I think what I would say is for me, it has to be somehow that change has to come through me. So the work for me is somehow through me and maybe just like one person at a time. Oh yeah, actually I had a conversation with the woman the other day who was talking about their niece who was switching pronouns and they didn't understand. And so I think for me, the work is like that, like one person at a time. And I was able to just kind of compassionately walk through with her and help her understand that this is not a phase, even though they really believed it was a phase. So I'm not sure I have a big message for the lawmakers, but I would like to hold space for those who don't understand and help them understand.
Absolutely. And that's definitely an important message with all the hatred and vitriol flinging and flying all over the place in our discourse, especially as we approach the November election here within the United States. I think that's powerful what you just said, Chris. Like, how can we center ourselves as a community to navigate these, you know, what can be difficult conversations, especially among a community of people, those mainly being cisgender and heterosexual, that don't have our lived experiences, don't have that sense of disembodiment that we as queer and trans people often have to navigate? How can we hold space for their lack of awareness, essentially? And that takes a tremendous amount of us being so thoroughly grounded and centered within ourselves that their lack of awareness isn't going to disturb us, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I feel like we can continue on and talk about that for hours. But
something else that we were taught in recovery is we can't change other people. You know, I can't change how other people think, act, speak. I can only change my attitude and the way I react to things. So if we can train ourselves, get grounded, like what you're saying, unbelievably grounded, and act and behave and have an attitude that is an example, I think that helps.
And that's why we all have to do our own inner work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And have the tools to do that work.
Yes.
Next question is, what is your number one tip for queer and trans youth?
I say find someone that you can trust, even if it's one person, and slowly build a support system, even if it's you and one other person, whether that be a relative, a neighbor, a teacher. Try to find at least one person that you can talk to, and they can be bear witness to your need for healing and your need for support.
Yeah, safe person. I love that, Robin. The first thing that came to my mind was stay strong, and you're doing this, like you're doing great. Keep going. And I love the idea of finding somebody like an ally, and then I'll go back to community because there are these spaces that do have places for young people. So look for them.
And do whatever it takes to be safe, to be heard, to be seen, to be loved, because we all deserve it.
Most definitely. Luckily, in some ways, I think it's becoming easier for that to occur. You know, I have people reaching out to you from all over the world. I have people contacting me from India, Afghanistan, Iraq, people in places that may not necessarily be in places that are allowed to have these conversations.
Absolutely.
Is what I'm saying.
We just had lunch with a lesbian couple. One of them is from Singapore, and they went back. And before they went back to go visit their family, she asked if she could take some of my business cards. Can she give their, you know, people back in Singapore the support group information and the podcast information, because they don't feel safe there and they don't have outlets. So I get it. We do here. South Africa. I mean, I hear from people all over the globe. We can't have these conversations.
Yeah, and the sheer fact that we can create the space on Zoom with people that do have access to internet service for them to be able to sit in their home and join a support group and to be able to share space with other queer and trans people globally is super powerful.
It really is.
So thank God for technology.
Yes.
What brings both of you the greatest sense of connection in this world? Robin, I'm loving your reaction.
I think the work I'm doing is bringing me the greatest sense of connection. And I would not have come to that realization without your question, Stevie. So thank you.
I'm so glad to hear it.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Helping people, being of service, and having some quiet. I think it's really important for me to have my own connection with myself and my intuition and my deepest me. Because without that, then I'm not connecting with others. So I need that first.
Finding the center within, as one of my Buddhist teachers phrases it.
Wonderful.
Good answer.
So where are both of you going from here? I know you have all these amazing things planned.
Where are we going from here, Chris?
Portland.
Yeah, Portland. The bigger picture, Chris and I really do want to meld our skills, our gifts. I think we're melding our missions and visions together. And we talk about that a lot, about how can we join forces. There's a great need in my coming out late community for Chris's skill set and gifts of yoga. And I think we're going to start to infuse more of that into the offerings and try to somehow figure out ways to do more than just 3 retreats a year, try to do some pop-up events that Chris and I can go to.
There's some things like behind the scenes that are happening that we can't really share yet, but hopefully a couple of pretty amazing things within the next year, maybe.
Oh, those things.
And like, those things, yeah.
Tell me about that. Or
yeah.
I mean, I've been blessed enough. I can tell one of them is Curve Magazine ran a best of the best representation of people who are doing good in the queer spaces. And I had asked my community, like, hey, vote me in, you know, let's see if we can. And the people that were nominated have been just enormous in their visibility compared to me. However, they did give me an honorable mention and whatever. So it gave me access to Franco Stevens, who started Curve Magazine. And in fact, Chris and I had been watching their documentary, Ahead of the Curve, in preparation for me to have Franco on my podcast. And I really can't wait for that. I feel as though all of us, all 3 of us, are taking her torch and running with it because she's tired. She's tired and she's done a lot. So that's one of the exciting things people can look for. And there's a few others. I was like, is Chris going to tell me?
Yeah. But Robin's running retreats in Portland and then Michigan and then Provincetown. That's next. And then we're always online.
Tonight we have a support group, Messy Middle Monday, it's called.
Wow.
Because people are in the messy middle. Yeah. Tuesday nights is the gender expansive support group. And Wednesday during the day, we have the not straight support group.
I love that.
Yeah.
And then the immediate what's next is we're going to go to the beach and go for a walk.
I was just going to say that.
Be healed by the waters. I love that. It's one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
So if people would like to find you, how can they get in touch?
For me, I would say email me at comingoutlater@gmail.com is probably the easiest, fastest way.
I don't have an easy access, but you can definitely put my email in the show notes. That'd be great.
Definitely. Well, sincere gratitude to both you, Chris and Robin, for being here on Queer Storytime. It was a heart-filled episode and a blessing to have both of you here in all your wisdom and glory and queerness.
Thank you so much for asking us.
It's been an honor to have you here. Thank you for being a part of the Queer Storytime community.
Enjoy your rest.
Yes, absolutely.
We'll see you soon, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't forget, y'all, stay tuned for episode 15 of Queer Storytime, as I have a big announcement that I'm going to make on that episode coming up in mid-August. So you won't want to miss out, because there's going to be further opportunities for you to engage with the Queer Storytime community that we are building. I'm so thrilled and excited to present that to you. Until next time. Stay healthy, vibrant, queer, and well, honeys. Hey, friends, I'm so delighted that you've made it this far. I sincerely hope that this episode has opened your heart and provided you with valuable insights into the lived experiences of those in gender and sexually expansive communities. There are several ways in which you can support this podcast. Make sure that you're subscribed if you haven't already done so, and be sure to share it with friends and family. Queer Storytime is a professionally produced podcast, which costs about $80 per episode. If you feel called to do so, I kindly ask that you support future episodes of this podcast by making a one-time or ongoing contribution that is sustainable to you. Links to contact me or to contribute to this podcast are found within the description of this episode. From the bottom of my queer heart to yours, I'm sincerely grateful for you tuning in to Queer Storytime, the podcast. Hugs and love, y'all. Until next time.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.